Good evening, everyone. My name is Chris Foy. I'm the president of the Leo Society. And tonight we're delighted to host Danny Dorling, Professor Danny Dorling of Oxford University. I'll introduce Danny in a bit, but first I just want to outline a bit of the sort of campaign that Danny's here to support, which is the campaign to get the University of Reading to pay its staff the living wage. The living wage is currently set at 67.65 an hour. And it's set independently what the amount is required to live a basic life. So it's set according to the basic costs of life, as opposed to the minimum one can get away of paying someone. Lots of other universities have signed up to it. Cambridge University have signed up to it. Queen Mary University have signed up to it. LSE have signed up to it. But Reading University, despite paying its top 34 staff £4 million in total and spending £2.6 million in marketing last year, have still pay a lot of their cleaning staff £6.50 an hour. I was talking to Nepalese lady the other day who was getting paid that, which is not enough to pay for your family in Reading, which is one of the top 10 most expensive places to rent in the UK. It's not enough for people to live a dignified life. So without further ado, I'll just introduce Danny. Danny's born in Oxford, where he studied, where he grew up, and he then went on to. I think you were quite a slow learner initially because you had some problems with dyslexia, but you managed to get to Newcastle University where you did your undergraduate, postgraduate, and then doctoral studies, and then Danny got a number of posts in human geography in Leeds. And Sheffield, before getting a very prestigious the Harald Mackinder professorship in Oxford University, where that was last year, and where he is today. He's written a number of extremely high-profile books about population growth, inequality, and the housing crisis, or lack of housing crisis. He's going to talk today about the inequality, 1% living wage, and the minimum wage.
Okay. Yeah, it's great. Thanks ever so much. Yeah. I thought I ought to say something about growing up slow, as you mentioned it. When I was about six, we had this lovely primary school teacher in my school, and she was so caring that she, with a hacksaw, sawed little badges for all of us to wear out of balsa wood, and then painted them lovingly in enamel paint. And one of my best friends, who was very quick, got his blue badge shaped like a beaver. And those were for the busy beavers on the beaver table. Because I couldn't read, and I was the slowest in the class, my little table got this lovely enamel red badge in the shape of an elephant for the slow ones. And in a way, it's kind of, you know, British society still works like that. In fact, if you're a primary school teacher, if you don't set children into different tables in your primary school by supposed ability, Ofsted will mark you down as not being that good. So that's the kind of society we still live in, and it partly explains why we don't have the living wage, because a set of children were brought up and they were always on the blue table with the beaver badges, and they did well at school and they did well at university, and they're told they're very, very able. And they found it relatively easy to get jobs and to get promoted and become head of departments in universities and then become senior management and become vice chancellors, be paid enormous salaries. And it's very hard for all of that to happen to you and for you not to believe that you're worth an enormous amount of money. And also, as that happens to you and you see other people being left behind, it's quite hard, I think, not to believe that some people really are just worth much, much less than other people. And part of what the Living Wage campaign about is tackling those kind of ideas about other human beings. Because not paying the living wage is saying it's okay for some people to have so little money that they can't hit the minimum for a basically decent life. And basically decent means not having to go to a food bank, being able to get a bus ticket, I'll describe it a little bit more to you, but when you decide, when you choose not to pay the living wage, and it's a choice, these universities could easily pay it. It doesn't even show up on the error in the balance sheets. When you choose not to do this, it is because you've got a core belief. When the living wage campaign, which I wasn't part of when it started at all, when it began, it was extremely hard to get the living wage into various institutions. The people who campaigned for it had to campaign very hard. They had to be extremely embarrassing to those above them, but they got it. Now it's becoming much, much easier to get the living wage. The living wage is going to roll out to a very large number of institutions. The only question is your institution going to be late or will it be early? That's essentially the decision. Reading will at some point in the next few years, could be 2 years, could be 10 years, will pay the living wage. All you can do is speed that up, from my point of view, and it doesn't take very many people to do that. But if nobody says anything, then you're going to be 10 years. If a few people do something, and they do it particularly effectively, you could easily be looking at having it within 2 years of now. I'll just talk for 5 minutes about what living wage is and why you need it, and then 5 minutes about how you get it. £7.65 an hour, worked out by people in Loughborough, paid by the Roundtree Foundation, who do the most incredibly detailed work with huge numbers of focus groups where they go through a list of things like washing up powder, like fairy liquid, like whether you ought to be able to afford a bird feeder or not, to work out what the minimally decent life in Britain is. The bird feeder, in case you're wondering about that, these are the items they always argue about, is only for pensioners. They've worked out that a pensioner sitting on their own, not some Maloney, should be able to have enough money in a pension to be able to buy a bird feeder. However, and this is using consensus focus groups of people in Britain, they should not get enough in their pension to be able to afford any grain to put in that bird feeder. The living wage for pensioners is that that's discretionary. If you want to feed birds, you should actually go without a little bit of food yourself. And that's how strict the living wage kind of calculations are. In practice, what you're talking about, if you look at university cleaners, and the majority of people you're talking about are cleaners in most universities, although I was interested to hear about the student wage in this one, which you would hope could mean you could galvanise more students because it's directly affecting the students who are employed in this university. Cleaner may well be on about £7, maybe £7.15 an hour. Quite a few on the minimum wage, which is £6.50 now, as long as you're old enough to get it. But in cities like Reading or in Oxford, just to be able to get people, having to pay a bit more. So when you talk about moving to a living wage, you're talking about paying people about 50p extra an hour. For most people, you'll be moving up. Cleaner who does a lot of cleaning tends to work about 20 hours a week. So that's £10 more a week. That's what you're trying to get. When you look at your university accounts, the university will produce accounts at the end of the year saying how many millions and millions have gone through. You're talking about £10 extra a week for a cleaner. The question is, what can you do with £10 extra a week? And the kind of thing you can do, because that's your discretionary money, you can just about eat. You can just about clothe yourself and your children on the minimum wage. If you're really frugal with £10 more a week, you can save it up, and after a year, you could buy a second-hand, really dodgy computer for about £500. And if you can buy a second-hand computer, then your 11 or 12 or 13-year-old child can use a computer at home when they do their homework, which gives them a chance of doing okay at GCSEs. It's that kind of thing you're talking about being able to do. And the reason I go on about that is that in Oxford, if you look at the city of Oxford, we have an incredible gradient in terms of how children do at school. We have some very expensive schools. We have schools where the academics send their children, which do pretty well. We have 5 comprehensives. And if you look at the bottom one of those comprehensives, the one that everybody who knows tries to avoid their children going to, It's in the bottom 25 in the country out of about over 2,000 secondary schools. So Oxford has one of the worst performing secondary schools in the country. Why does it have one of the worst performing secondary schools? This is a city that's supposed to be famous for education. Almost all the rest of the bottom 25 are in pit villages and other places that have really fallen apart. It's because that part of town is where the people on the lowest wages are concentrated. People who cannot afford to buy their children a second-hand computer, so they can't do well at their GCSEs. Why do children do very badly in terms of education in Oxford? Because the University of Oxford decides not to pay their parents enough money for them to live a very basic life, and the hospitals and a few other employees. But you're basically talking about children in this. In that it's not that people take the extra 50p an hour and go and drink it down the pub. People who've got very little money are incredibly good at managing money. Have to be. And they tend to use it for things like giving their children basics. So that's what your university is deciding not to allow when it decides not to have a living wage. There are many more arguments for living wage. A report came out from the Smith Institute today, just showing that productivity is higher, people do a better job, everything works better if you paid living wage. So even if you don't care about kids or about people, it actually makes sense to pay the living wage. Cleaning is done better when people are paid slightly more to clean. They're slightly less resentful of the situation they're put in. You can actually get a little more choice of people to clean. You can go to the most equal countries in the rich world and you'll find that cleaners are paid twice as much as they're paid here. Cleaning is actually then done with less people and done better. People are actually even proud of being cleaners. I've been to countries where people have been proud to actually clean. And things need to be cleaned. Our hospitals need to be cleaned. Universities don't need to be cleaned as much, but students are fairly dirty that way. You do want to clean them up to a basic level, because when you bring this number of people together, there are germs and so on. You know, this is an absolutely necessary job to do. So there are many more reasons you can give for it. But let's get on, because actually most of you are probably in favour of this, otherwise you wouldn't have bothered to come along. So it's how do you get it? The first thing you've got to realise is that you are up against a group of people who really don't want to pay it. It's not about the money. The money is absolutely tiny. It really isn't. The first thing that management often do is try and calculate a total sum. This is how much it would cost university, and we'd have to put everybody up who's being paid a bit more than that, because we can't have the differentials upset, because it would upset people on £8 an hour if so on. And they'll calculate a sum and say, how can you possibly pay £100,000 a year or whatever? And you've only got to look at what they spend on new buildings or what they spend on new staff or what they actually spend on the salaries of the people at the top compared to what they spent on the salaries of people at the top 10 years ago or 20 years ago to realise it's not the money. The entire sector's had a £1 billion boost in the last few years. Aware of that because of £9,000 fees. £9,000. We didn't expect the fees to all be 9,000. We were a bit slow, but at least those who put in the fees, they thought there would be a differential set of fees, and some universities would charge 8 and 6 and 7. We'd have a market. Whole lot bang up to £9,000. The entire sector gets an extra £1 billion a year income. That's coming to an end soon, because as each of these new cohorts come in, I think, is it the new first years who've just arrived or the last group? And the third years of the first group who did pay it. Okay. So that boost is going to come an end. So the kind of incredible good times. I mean, it's an amazing story. The whole country has had austerity. Other sectors like the police and the army have had 20-25% cuts. Universities were faced with 25% cuts. What the government did, in fact, what the Conservatives did to Nick Clegg is turn around to him and say, well, we can either give them 25% cuts or you can break your promise and go for 9,000. And how many academics did you see opposing 9,000? And it was because you're basically looking at losing 1 in 4 jobs. But the sector has had this incredible bonus short term because of this, so it's never actually had more spare money swilling around. It's a little bit worried about the fact that that increase is going to tail off, but there is enough money. You have to recognise that people are deeply opposed. Some people are deeply opposed to paying people this amount of money because they don't think they're worth it. Those kind of people are rare. Most people are what's called pro-social. There have been lots of nice studies about this and how human beings are. Most of us are nice. Some people are a little bit more psychotic. The people who are a little bit more psychotic are more likely to end up getting promoted or push themselves forward, and so you end up with a concentration of them at the top of organisations. I'm generalising quite a lot, but it's useful to not assume that the people at the top think like you think. You're more likely to think how most people think. They are not. But living wage has been won in various places, and once it becomes won, it's far easier to win. It's going through the various boards of Oxford University now for the centre of the university to become a living wage employer. The tragedy at Oxford, and the great advantage you've got, is that in Oxford there are more than 40 separate employers. The centre of the university is only a few admin buildings. It's likely by Christmas to be a living wage employer. But the divisions, the academic departments, make separate decisions. It's entirely possible that one division will start paying it, but the others won't. There are over 30 colleges in Oxford, which are all entirely separate legal entities. Half of them are paying the living wage, half of them are not. The number's increasing, and there are campaigns, but it's much more of a slog, if you see what I mean. And, you know, your job is easier. You've only got one employer. You have to do two jobs as an employer. One is they have to say that they will not employ anybody unless living wage. And secondly, they will issue in the subcontracts they give out to any firms that they hire that a condition of being considered in a shortlist to be hired to work for this university is that you're a living wage employer. But that's all they've got to do. Why is Oxford doing this? The short answer is Cambridge. You see how it works? And that's how this will work. If Cambridge can do it, why can't Oxford do it? And this is why I say this thing is going to spread. It looks really bad if you don't do it. Because every year, universities produce reports about how many millions of research income they brought in and what donations they've got and so on, and they show what huge amounts of figures. And it's very easy for a journalist or another group to turn around and say, are you in financial difficulties? Is that why you can't pay this? Or is it simply because you really don't want to do it? Universities are incredibly sensitive about media and publicity. We're not yet at the stage of some US universities, which actually spend more on marketing than on teaching, which shows how sensitive they are to publicity. It's all about getting people in. It really doesn't matter how much you spend on teaching them. You've got to get them in, and you know, you're 18, 19, 20. How do you know whether your teaching's any good or not? Universities are extremely sensitive about publicity. Because we now have an open market at the top end in where you can go, any university can take any number of students on AAA, AAB, ABB, and I think soon BBB. And the plan currently, although they may scrap it, the plan currently is next year's intake is a complete free-for-all. Reading could take 200,000 students, right? It would have to put tents up, it would have to pray the river doesn't flood, but Reading could take 200,000 students, if that goes through. Reading already is in a position, because the grades for entry are so high on so many courses, to take as many students as it can fit in. And what do you do when you've got a choice between taking a student or not? You're going to get £27,000 if you take them. You know, how can you see what they do? They take them. But there's a limited number of students, because too few of us had, well, unprotected sex 18 years ago, to put it very simply. The birth cohort has been falling. So all these universities are chasing a fixed number of people. There are obvious winners. Bristol's an obvious winner. It's taken a lot more. Exeter is the biggest increase. And you get some idea of the actual real revealed preferences of where people actually really wanted to be. For years and years, lots of home county students used to say, I want to go up north for 3 years turns out when we gave them the choice that Liverpool and Sheffield and Leeds and Manchester were not quite as high on their hit list as they had been saying, and I suspect it's more mum and dad because they're making lots of the choices. But anyway, students are not going as far from home and they're not going as far north. But the universities are engaged in a battle to try to get bums on seats, and the last thing they want is any bad publicity. So I think one reason why they're just falling over and tipping one at a time to paying the living wage is that they just see this as a big risk on their risk register of what could go wrong. A few stories in newspapers about it and it becomes a much higher risk and you get it faster. That's just one way in which these things happen. They also happen for idiosyncratic events. A college appoints a new master, new boss, and that boss walks in, discovers that the place isn't paying living wage and just says, I'm not going to have this. And that's been one reason why places have suddenly switched. A single individual with power who is quicker than their governing body changes it. You get a new vice chancellor here. There's a very good chance that the new vice-chancellor may simply use their walking into the building to decide that this just has to happen and has to happen fast. And it can happen that way, but you can't guarantee that event will occur, so you need to push it. You push it by having a website, preferably linked to your student union. You can simply copy the websites of other student unions that say that you have this campaign, it exists. It either exists or it doesn't. You either have the websites or you don't. If you can put them up there, you put the wording so you don't have to update it that much. You can do this with very minimal effort. Petitions are good, other things are good. I've got no objection to demonstrations, but just one phone call to the right journalist and you can get a story about this, which is as effective as a demonstration that involved 50 of you and quite a lot of effort and shouting. It's worth looking at your alumni list to see what famous journalists went to the University of Reading, because then they have a reason for doing it, and you just put on the pressure. In other places, the pressure initially came from the people actually living on the minimum wages. So it came from London citizens at the start and from cleaners and so on themselves, but it's very hard to do that. And the last reason, because I think I've probably talked for long enough, and we'll move you around and get you to talk, is even if you don't care about people, even if you aren't worried that poor families can't buy their children a second-hand computer or afford for their kids to go on the basic school trip so everybody knows that their kids are poor and so on, even if you think that's fine, even if you happen to have some idea of humanity where you think they're a sort of subhuman goblins as part of the human race, you know, and they are different and you're genetically superior, even if that's your view, it's still stupid not to pay the living wage because of that risk to reputation. You know, what is it about the University of Reading that means it's unable to do this? Because even if you believe it's okay not to do it, the majority of students coming to your university will be in favour of it because they're normal people. They're pro-social. They're not part of that group who do view some human beings as dirt. The majority of their parents will be normal, decent people. And if you're searching and trying to think, where is my option number 2 or 3 or 4 going to be on the UCAS form? And somehow the fact that this university isn't paying it, whereas the one just up the road is, or Queen Mary can and this one can't, it's often a pretty marginal decision where you put things on that UCAS form. So even if you don't believe it's a good thing to pay it, if you're trying to make your university successful, it's a good thing to pay it. So I think you can press on this side. The reasons people at the top, in the top committees, who decide not to do this, and one thing that often happens is that it just never comes up year after year to do it, but the reasons they decide not to do it is a mixture of either being stupid or a little bit evil. And they don't want to be seen as either stupid or evil. People in universities are particularly upset about being portrayed as stupid, because universities are not supposed to be about being stupid. I'm not advocating being terribly rude, so I wouldn't use these particular words on any website or in literature. I would use much more reasonable words, but where the implication between the lines is this. You don't want to get somebody's back up who is very close to making a decision towards what you are trying to get, but you do want to help them get to that decision within 2 years rather than within 10 years. And if there is no push on the campus at all, they're much more likely to be slow. A couple of people can have the effects of having a push. I'll give you just one last example about a couple of people, and then we'll do this strange thing and get you talking, and then we'll do some questions. I know two lovely people who run the 20 Plenties campaign. It's completely different. It's a campaign to get 20 mile an hour roads in residential areas. Yeah. Have you got 20 mile an hour in Reading?
Yeah. In the old Redlands area, it's a trial area, basically where most, if not about 70% of students live.
And also in front of a lot of schools as well.
In front of schools, Because the most likely way in which a student's going to die is being hit by a car. Yeah. That's the biggest risk. We're all from geography departments, and we have to fill in these risk assessments when we take kids away on field trips. And the biggest problem is crossing the road on the way. You may do particularly dangerous things, but... these two people who did the 20 Plenties campaign, it's largely them. They've now got over 100 local authorities and now 20 mile an hour in all their roads apart from the arterial roads. Just two of them. Just kept on at it. And now they've got to a point where their main message is, are your local councillors particularly slow? Is there something wrong with your area? Because nearby, in a place you'd rather live, where things work better, the traffic has been slowed down. So it's going at 20, which is not killing speed. Small children get killed when they hit at 30. Just two people. I am constantly surprised the older I get, the more I begin to discover how few people are actually involved in things that were successful, how few it took to do it. But a little bit of dogginess and a little bit about being clever and a little bit about not being scared. Very last thing to tell you, when I was doing a talk to the students about the Living Wage campaign in Oxford, they came over as particularly kind of confident and knew what they're doing in a kind of slightly annoying way in which Oxford University students tend to be more confident than average, and I was quite impressed. And then three of them came sidled up to me later on and said, do you think it'll affect our marks? And I suddenly realised that they were only 19, 20. For all that kind of bravado and confidence that they had, they were still scared. And I can understand why people are scared, but nobody goes through an anonymised mark list trying to pick out students. You know, I mean, you'd have to imagine if some evil vice-chancellor going, give me their student number and I'll take 10 away. But these supposedly, you know, activist students at Oxford kind of had an idea that they were somehow going to be marked down for this. And I think that's one thing that slows people down, is not realising. They get really upset if you lock yourself into vice-chancellor's office for 3 days. They do not get upset if you do anything which is lawful. Universities are amazingly liberal as long as things are lawful. And then sometimes they can flip a bit. Short term. And the other problem you have, last thing, is you're only, most of you, just here for a short amount of time.